asymptotically anti-dissipators based time setting in the fully dynamical nonlinear regime. The statement of this question is based on the notion of holography that d-dimensional quantum field theory, for example, one that might serve as a toy model for QCD, let's say, ought to admit a description in terms of gravity in d plus 1 dimensions. The ADS-CFT correspondence is a particular realization of this principle, and it also provides a precise framework for computing quantities on either side of the duality. Today, we'll be further solidifying this principle with an explicit numerical framework for tackling the problem of general relativity with asymptotically ADS boundaries, and then showing how in practice one actually takes those spacetimes and produces CFT observables. The first thing I'd like to do is to make more sense of this entire program by motivating it in terms of the physics it's intended to clarify. I'll then give a brief overview of anti-dissipator space and the prescription that we'll need to translate from space-time to conformal field theories. After briefly going through our method for solving the anti-dissipator space-time problem, I'll dive straight to our concrete example. Our concrete example for today will be an oblately deformed asymptotically anti-dissipator black hole. And this is an interesting example, and I picked it for today because it's designed in such a way that the dual conformal field theory, as we will see, will mimic the behavior of the quark gluon plasma. This is the remnant of a heavy ion collision that's formed at the relativistic heavy ion collider up at Brookhaven National Labs. We'll find that, first of all, the stress tensor of this conformal field theory is consistent with what we'd expect a fluid. And we'll also do an extra transformation to take us closer to the experiment. We'll do a transformation to Minkowski space. I'll close then with some ongoing explorations. The first of these would be a direct logical consequence of everything that's happened so far. I mean, given a flow in Minkowski space, to make an even closer contact with experiment, we'd really like particle spectra. This is what the experimentalists see. And this is the first listed item here. We'll be applying the Cooper-Fry prescription for obtaining the particle spectrum of free-streaming hadrons after the fluid phase that has subsided in the experiment. And this is work with JPM. After this, I'll be talking a little bit about some work with Franz and Steve in extending our code to include more kinds of matter. And in particular, we'll be including matter that actually deforms the boundaries. And this has interesting implications with ADS-CFT correspondence, as we'll see very soon. And finally, there are simulations now that we're working on for non-black hole space time. So for today, we'll be taking the attitude, well, the ADS-CFT correspondence is a statement about two equivalent descriptions of type 2B string theory in the presence of n coincident B3 brains. But for today, we'll be taking the attitude that we'd like an operational definition, operational in the sense that we just like to take the minimal ingredients that we're going to need and we're actually going to use for today's purposes. And those minimal ingredients are five-dimensional anti-dissipator space, and the fact that it's dual to super Young-Mills conformal field theory. So we're going to be looking at asymptotically anti-dissipator space-time, so it's not just going to be pure super Young-Mills on the other side of the correspondence, but rather excited states. And the hope, since the beginnings of the ADS-CFT correspondence, is that we'll eventually be able to use this duality to make experimentally testable predictions in non-abelian gauge theories like QCD, for example. The first historical attempt at this was with heavy ion physics, and the leading facility for this kind of physics is the relativistic heavy ion collider down at Brookhaven National Laboratories. And it's since 2010, it's been joined by the LHC. Now, many problems in non-abelian gauge theory, such as QCD, are non-perturbative. So that means that the usual Feynman graph expansions are of limited utility. And so a gravity description is highly desirable. So now we're left with two questions, really, at this point. First of all, what exactly is it that happens at these heavy ion collisions? What happens at RIC? And second, what does the conformal field theory have to do with any of it, whatever it is that happens? So this is a cartoon of what actually the particle collision looks like. So I'm displaying here the moment of impact. So this is when two highly Lorentz contracted gold atoms have finally met and are about to interact. So just as a note, gold atoms in the rest frame look spherical. They're 7 femtometers radius. But at RIC, they actually boost them to such velocities that the lengths contract in such a way that you get 0.07 femtometers from side to side. So it's a Lorentz factor of 100. It's pretty high. LHC does 2,700, or at least that's their goal. So here, at the moment of collision, what we'll see is these particles the partons will interact with each other in such a way that they actually form, they actually have a collective motion, as it turns out. It turns out that the soup of quarks and gluons behave in a way that's consistent with a fluid, and not just any fluid, one with a very low viscosity. So this happens for a few femtoseconds. And eventually, at this point in the simulation, this is actually a simulation of QCD-inspired simulation of particles, hadronization occurs. And at this point, the fluid constituents will just transition into free-streaming hadrons. So the goal for today will be to model this part of the collision. We won't be starting with, you know, two gold atoms. We'll be starting at the moment of impact, and we'll be trying to create a model of the gravity on the gravity side that models how this QGP evolves until the moment of hadronization. And at that moment of hadronization, we're going to derive a particle spectrum of how the particles are going to free stream away at that hypersurface. Now, the problem with applying ADS-CFT to problems, real-world problems like this, is that traditionally, particle physics is described by QCD because it very well describes everything we've observed so far. However, there is no such thing as ADS-QCD at the moment. We have no known gravity dual of QCD. What we have, however, is a duality between anti-de Sitter space and a conformal field theory. So the question is, how well is this conformal field theory, which turns out to be supersymmetric Young-Mills theory, model QCD? And it turns out pretty well. And the reason is this, that the salient feature of supersymmetric Young-Mills that we're going to be interested in is conformal invariance. That means that it's somehow insensitive to changes in scale. Now, you could translate that into a statement about the beta function of the theory. So that might be one way of saying it's the beta function is zero in some region. And it turns out in QCD, you actually have, you know, at least in the regime that RIC is operating in, there are some arguments that QCD is very nearly, or at least behaves in a conformal-like fashion. And that gives us some indication that we ought to be able to use the ADS-CFT correspondence in the regime that RIC is operating in. So we're going to take this attitude that despite the fact that we don't have an ADS-QCD correspondence, we're nevertheless going to apply the ADS-CFT correspondence and see what can we extract the essential physics of this complicated real-world phenomenon using a toy model, essentially, of gravity dual to QCD. So our point of entry now, then, is anti-de Sitter space. What is it? Here are really all the features of anti-de Sitter space that are relevant. But what I'd like to point out for the purposes of today especially for the purposes of trying to get a Cauchy evolution working in these kinds of spacetimes is the boundary. So the relevant feature here is that the boundary is time-like. This is in contrast with asymptotically Minkowski spacetimes, if you remember the Penrose diagram for that. And to really appreciate why it's so different, so imagine you were sitting in the interior of Minkowski space, let's say. You send off a light ray. It'll never come back at you. It's gone forever. However, in anti-de Sitter space, or more generally, asymptotically anti-de Sitter spacetimes, you're sitting in the middle of the spacetime. You send out light rays, and it will come back at you. And not just that, but it'll come back at a finite proper time as measured on your clock. So basically what I'm trying to tell you is that the boundary is causally connected with the interior. And from the point of view of a Cauchy evolution, that means that if you start off with a initial data on any spatial slice, that will never be enough to obtain the full time development of the spacetime. You need to supply boundary conditions. And that is the entire name of the game in this business. Here are the boundary conditions. And they can be derived several ways. It's essentially a choice, to be honest. In the context of scalar fields that we're looking at right now, so in ADS, there are two modes. There are two types of solutions, two fall-offs for scalar fields. There's one that falls off quickly, one that falls off slowly. The one that falls off quickly is called the normalizable modes. And that's the first part of this talk will be about the normalizable modes. And it turns out that if you make the choice that you only turn on the normalizable modes, or if you only turn on vacuum, like a black hole spacetime, for example, with no matter at all, then these are the boundary conditions that are relevant. They can, for example, be derived from requiring the SO42 symmetry of pure ADS to be valid asymptotically, even in asymptotically. That's just one way of doing it. So for the purposes of later on, let's just do a little bit of notation here. Let's rewrite this entire metric. So as I'll point out to you later on again, notice in this diagram, I'm depicting five-dimensional space, but somehow it's in a 3D sort of diagram. So at each point in this little cartoon, there's actually a hidden internal two-sphere geometry. So you might think that's just a nice visual way of representing it. It's actually more convenient than that because in our code, we preserve those two spheres. We keep track of how they breathe in and out. We don't let them deform. So basically, we're preserving a two-sphere piece in our metric. It's a simplification. It makes the simulation 2+1. But it's a fairly good one, as we'll see for now. And we could relax it very easily, because this scheme is based on Cauchy evolution. So for now, let's decompose this full metric in terms of an ADS piece and a deviation from pure ADS. This need not be a perturbation, let me stress. It can be anything. It can be as large as you want. And in this notation, we'll just talking about the boundary conditions in this way. It's just much more simple. So the first thing I'd like to do is to give you some intuition about what this picture of ADS looks like from the point of view of simulation. So in this cartoon, what I'll be doing is taking some initial slice, let's say at t equals 0, of this half cylinder, and then putting two lumps of scalar field in the interior of the spacetime, anywhere you want, one near the boundary, maybe one here. But I'll also arrange for trapped surfaces to be present at a centered around the origin here. You don't see it yet because the apparent horizon finder hasn't turned on quite yet. But I assure you it's there. And after the first time slice, you see that the horizon appears. And what I'm showing you here is how these two lumps of scalar field are accreted by the black hole. And notice this is a logarithmic scale. So the scalar fields were eaten almost instantaneously. But this should give you some intuition about how the simulations later on will look like. This, the radial coordinate is in this direction. The boundary of ADS is this curved region here. And the one angular coordinate, the other spatial coordinate that we're considering, is simply this direction along the boundary. And remember, again, there are internal two-sphere geometries at each point in this diagram, and we're keeping track of their dilatation factors. So it's there in the metric. Given a gravity simulation like that, in general, what we'd like to do is to take the metric variables, so for example, g bars I'm talking about here, and convert them into, for example, one-point functions of the CFD stress tensor. You can construct anything based. You can construct two-point functions, three-point functions, but for now we'll concentrate on the one-point function. And the strategy we'll be using, even though the correspondence allows us to go both ways, is to go from the gravity side and then reconstruct the field theory side, given a concrete numerical simulation of the full GR. And the question now that we ought to ask ourselves is, how do these bulk gravitational fields encode the boundary CFD operators exactly? I mean, this is a nice statement to make, but we really need an explicit procedure. And here it is. As you can see, the fine print is long. But what essentially I'd like you to take away from this is that on the left-hand side, we have a CFT observable. It's the one-point function of the CFT stress tensor. And on the right, it seems like a complicated mess. But it really, everything there is computable from simply the metric. If you have the metric, you can evaluate this thing as long as you know what it is these quantities are. It's all listed down here. But it's not important at the moment. Really, all you need to know is that there's a limiting prescription for obtaining any quantity you want on the CFT side. So if we are to do this, we first have to know how to obtain the metric in the first place. So we're now in the region of numerical relativity and asymptotically anticipatory spacetimes. So in any numerical relativity simulation, the first place to start is initial data. And the reason for this is that in GR, you can't just use any initial data. It has to satisfy certain constraints in the same way that Gauss's law, for example, constrains electromagnetism. So in the case of GR, there are two equations. You can decompose them into two equations. They're essentially projections of the Einstein equations onto the hypersurface in question. There are the momentum constraints, the Hamiltonian constraint. I'd like to show you this because in our simulations, we make certain assumptions about the initial data to make the problem simpler. And it'll have repercussions for the kinds of super young Mill states that we can get. So first, we're going to assume that on our initial slice, the initial data is conformal to pure ADS. So that means that instead of solving for some generic metric on some spatial hypersurface, we're going to just say, this metric is actually just some, it's pure ADS multiplied by some space-time dependent factor, zeta. So that really reduces the problem. You could basically, some tensor equation becomes a scalar equation. And the last thing is that we're going to assume time symmetry. So what that does for us is that the momentum constraints are trivially satisfied, so time symmetry. And the conformality means that the Hamiltonian constraint, which is left, takes this form. It's an elliptic equation. It's nonlinear, but it's just one equation. It's easy enough to solve. And you can do this with a multigrid algorithm. And as soon as you have initial data, what you'd like is a rule for going from time slice to time slice. And that's, of course, provided by the evolution equations. We use the generalized harmonic form. As you may be familiar, it's motivated by the Donder or harmonic gauge that's familiar in mathematics. Generalize this in such a way that instead of just making the coordinates satisfy box x mu equals 0, we'll define these source functions h mu. And what we've done there is essentially encoded all the coordinate degrees of freedom into these source functions. And so specifying a gauge, or in other words, specifying a coordinate system in this formalism, amounts to specifying the h mu. And this will become important shortly. And the point of this entire procedure is to make the field equations take on a wave-like character. And here they are, the Einstein field equations in generalized harmonic form. Now, in our simulations, as I'd already mentioned, we are imposing the symmetry that acts in the two spheres at each point in every diagram and movie I've shown so far. So clearly, it's an SO3 symmetry. And the form of the metric, again, is this. We have this subsector, the T rho chi subsector, is completely evolved, but this last subsector in theta and phi, we only keep track of in terms of a dilatation factor. So that means we have seven independent components of the metric. These last two, of course, can be kept track of just one. That's something related to the psi I've written there. That's the boundary conditions are written in this form for each of these seven components. And the evolved variables that we're going to use are such that we've factored up enough factors of the radial fall off such that these new barred variables always fall off linearly near the boundary. And that just makes it easier to numerically implement in the code. And similarly, we do this for all the source functions. There are three of them in our symmetries. And we do this for the massless scalar that we're looking at. So these are all the evolved variables in the code. And the last thing I'd like to mention before moving on to the physics is just what is the big deal about evolving in anti-de Sitter space? I mean, it should be the same, right? One of the problems is that the gauge choice has some subtleties, and it's tied into the asymptotics that I was talking about before. And it's also tied into the fact that any reasonable representation of the metric, the field equations, in an asymptotically anti-de Sitter spacetime will have divergences as you approach the boundary. It's related to the physical fact that even though the boundary is infinitely far away, you could get there in finite proper time. So intuitively, you'd expect some divergent behavior in the metric. There's something going on that makes that possible. So to see what the problem might be, try to expand around the boundary. So in our coordinates, the boundary is at rho equals 1. So this is the usual, this is the first thing you would think about. Why not just look at what the field equations look like at the region of the problematic region? And you find equations that look something like this. So the left-hand side here, the box tilde g bar 1 tt, just a schematic form for the tth component of the field equations. And on the right-hand side is what it looks like in powers of 1 minus rho. Remember, the boundary is at rho equals 1. So near rho equals 1, this should be a very small thing. And you see straight away, the field equations are indeed divergent there. It's second order. And remember that for a solution of the field equations, everything on the right-hand side has to equal 0. And in numerical evolution, the goal of an iterative scheme like the one we use is to find the G bars and H bars such that is true. However, you can see why this is a problem, because we never evolve right at the boundary itself, where this thing is 1 over 0 squared, which we evolve at one point near the boundary. But you can see, as you go to higher and higher resolutions, this thing is a bad quantity. It's divergent. So you would think that the numerical scheme would be able to handle that, but that means that you have to be so accurate, your scheme has to be so accurate that it offsets the fact that you have this 1 over 0 squared, essentially, multiplying everything in your field equations. So a trick that we use is the following. Remember that we have this freedom, all the coordinate degrees of freedom we've encoded in our source functions. Now, given what I've shown you here, it's very suggestive what you can do to help ameliorate the situation. I mean, if you have the freedom to choose h bar 1 rho, then why not just choose h bar 1 rho to be such that this entire piece just goes away? And you've already made things better by canceling out a divergent, by explicitly, sometimes canceling out the divergent piece essentially for free, because here this is just the coordinate choice. And this turns out to work for us. It's not clear if this is a unique choice, and almost certainly it's not, in fact, given my experience with another kind of spacetime that I'll be showing you later on. But it's certainly an empirical way of handling the divergences of ADS within this framework, within the fact that you're free to, it's very clear where your coordinate degrees of freedom are, and it's very clear, you know, how you could use it.
That means that you don't impose the boundary conditions which time that you are
recording because of that choice. I think that's correct what you said, but I didn't catch the first part, I'm sorry.
So because the choice that you do for HR1,
yeah,
because that one go away means that you are not imposing the boundary conditions for each condition.
We are. The way we impose them is by imposing a fall off. We don't impose, for example, reflecting boundary conditions. We impose the fact that the metric components are falling off at the requisite falloffs. If we do not do that, then you know we have no control over the boundaries at all.
And because of this, do you try any other functions?
Functions? Yeah, we have.
Evolution looks
similar. That's right, except for the fact that. So let me just say, if you take the most naive choice, set h bar equals zero, for example, that will not give you the same evolution. And the reason is, you can see here what that implies. That implies that somehow the gauge choice that you chose is not consistent with the fall off that you were asking for at the beginning. But you're right, there is a certain class of gauge choices that work, and they will give you the same physical results, but the evolution itself will look different. Because it's gauge. It's basically gauge.
Your coordinates is dot 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 guaranteed to be
no.
Non-singular?
No, it is not. In fact, there is a 1 minus rho, there's a unity, and then so on. So this is why it's not a unique choice. And in fact, that's why I'm still searching for a more satisfying answer to this question. Because to be perfectly rigorous about it, you have to cancel that piece as well. Because if you don't do it explicitly, then you would naively you would expect that you're still going to get divergent evolution. However, what turns out to happen is that the evolution sorts itself out. I mean that was the initial expectation, right? That despite this, the evolution ought to be able to find a way to set all of this to zero anyway. It's simply the fact that it's difficult numerically because you have a divergent piece. But it turns out that if you cancel out just the 1 over 0 squared bits, and you're left with just 1 over 0 to the power of 1, then it turns out to be...
Are you able to cancel all the 1 over 0 squared? Because you have more variables than
correct.
Gauge functions.
Correct. We are, except for one piece. It's an off-diagonal... piece in the T chi, and it's related to the extra piece is a chi derivative, if I remember correctly, chi derivative over 1 over 0 squared. So for spherical symmetry, it doesn't matter, but for the cases we're considering, it should, but somehow it still works itself out. So this is why I'm still unsatisfied with it, because this is clearly an empirical way of doing it. But the structure is telling us that there must be some more fundamental way of understanding this. But I have not been successful yet. Yeah. Right. So I'd like now to transition to our concrete example. But before that, I'd just like to refresh your memory on some salient features of asymptotically anti-de-Sitter black holes. So here I am displaying this metric variable. It's related to the dilatation factor that keeps track of the breathing of the two spheres. Okay, so I always start with Gaussian initial data, and it's Gaussian but with different widths on in these axes. So I could make it such that, and it's longer this way, it's shorter this way. That's exactly what I did here. And it turns out that this is the way it impinges on that particular metric variable. You get two lumps, and then. So this is for what I claim will eventually settle down to an ABS Schwarzschild black hole. Because remember, any deformed black hole in ABS will always settle down to a spherically symmetric one with these boundary conditions. We'll settle down to a black hole of radius 12.2 in units of the ADS length scale. So I've set the ADS length scale to 1 here. But remember, everything in ADS is measured with respect to the ADS length scale, capital L. So this is a fairly large black hole. And I mean, before we see the simulation, what do we expect? Well, in terms of quasi-normal modes, we know that the larger you make the black hole, the longer it takes for the quasi-normal modes to damp away. So here we are. We see fairly large black hole, and we see it breathing, and it continues breathing, and this will continue on for the several light crossing times of, with no signs of abating really. So the lifetime of these quasi-normal modes for large black holes is fairly long, exactly as you would expect. Now you could contrast this with a small black hole, for example. So here's one. I made it so small that it's actually, it will settle down to an ADS Schwarzschild of around the ADS length scale. And we see that this one settles down immediately, essentially. It's just, it's just damped down in less than one light crossing time. So that's a great reminder to all of us. For today, though, for the actual translation to the conformal field theory side, I'll be using an intermediate case. So I'll be looking at, here's an example shape of the Gaussian. This is the scalar field variable now I'm showing you. Here's the deformed Gaussian shape. The deformation parameter here, I've not displayed it. We call it WY over WX. This one happens to be for a WY over WX equals 32. That's the highest deformation we've considered so far. The first thing I'd like to do before going on to the conformal field theory is just show you how this thing evolves and just remind you not just about the metric quasi-normal modes, but the scalar quasi-normal modes as well. So the salient feature you see here is that, first of all, this thing is decaying pretty rapidly. And second of all, the features that remain are very high harmonic features. So this is just reminding you again, the analytic result that the higher harmonics when you do a decomposition, a spherical decomposition in the scalar modes, they last longer. And here's how it impinges on another metric component. So this is what we're going to translate now to the conformal field theory side. And remembering that prescription for the CFT stress tensor, we can directly take these metric solutions, put them into the machinery, and obtain an expectation value for the stress tensor. And we obtain something like this. What I've done here is to take the boundary. Remember, it's the half cylinder. And unfold it in this direction. So here was what was chi equals 0, was chi equals pi. And I've displayed it as a space-time diagram in time that goes upwards in this direction. So remember, we started off with a lump in the middle at chi equals pi over 2. And we see that this the dynamics of this CFT is such that this lump propagates outwards to the poles. Propagation goes back. Back to the poles, goes back. So it's oscillating, but in such a way that it eventually becomes a homogeneous sort of profile as you go to t goes to infinity in global time. Exactly as you'd expect. You start off with an inhomogeneous profile, and you eventually end up with just a constant energy density. Now, the expectation, of course, is that these sort of CFTs would have fluid-like behavior. Now, the surprising thing that we found was that we found this a CFT stress tensor that's consistent with hydrodynamics essentially from the outset. Now, this is surprising because there are several other works that have demonstrated a certain thermalization time before hydrodynamics actually kicks in. Now, the way I had previously understood this was in terms of the fact that we had a black hole to begin with, and though, so in my mind anyway, you could explain it by the fact that you already have a notion of temperature. However, it's been brought to my attention recently that this is not necessarily be the case. You can get thermalization time with a black hole. So perhaps what I'm going to show now is the fact that we have thermalization time from the very beginning may change as we go to higher and higher deformation parameters. And in the context of the field theory, in the context of this fluid, for example, which has velocity v, this corresponds to going to higher and higher velocity fields, or higher and higher velocities of the fluid. But what I'd like to demonstrate first is that this is indeed a fluid. So the first things you can check are conservation, because remember, hydrodynamics is simply a conservation law with an equation of state. And we see that the trends, if we go from the coarsest resolution, the blue, to the highest resolution, the green, the trends indicate that indeed we do get something that's conserved. And we also have an expectation for what the equation of state is. We expect this to be a conformal fluid, since it's in the conformal field theory. And for a conformal fluid, the energy density is just 3 times the pressure. And sure enough, if we compute this difference normalized by the energy density, we see again that the trends are converging to zero. And this is just a zoomed in region of the early time. I remember we had a question about the gauge. This we attribute mostly to the fact that our gauge, the gauge transitions that we have near t equals zero are not yet perfect. Nevertheless, we see that as you go to higher and higher resolution, the region in which this transient occurs is becoming smaller and smaller. So we have the fact that it's a fluid. What we'd like to ask now is, what kind of fluid? And the way you could ask this is in terms of the exact form of this stress tensor. So I've written here the ideal fluid piece that I'm going to call T naught. There's a first order viscous correction, T1, and there are higher order corrections, let's say second order, T2. And we know exactly how to compute all of these via ADS-CFT. I won't display the actual expressions, but here we have the actual expression. Eta turns out to be related to the number of, to NC, the rank of the gauge group. It's NC squared over 8 pi squared times pi temperature cubed, I think, is the expression for eta. And there are similar transport coefficients in this pi that I'm hiding here. I won't display them. But what we'll do now is try to see if our extracted T mu nu is consistent with just an ideal fluid, or do we need first order viscous corrections as well, or do we need even more viscous corrections to describe the fluid that we get from gravity. And the surprising thing that we find is that to very high consistency, if we add enough viscous corrections, we could explain all of the data that we get. So here's one. Let's suppose we thought it was an ideal fluid. Well, the trends are telling us no, it is not. So the first plot here is for a reasonably deformed black hole case. So again, that means that the velocities of this fluid are mediocre, maybe around 0.1, the speed of light. And this is the highest deformation case we consider. Again, that means higher velocities in the conformal field theory side. And this turns out to reach maximal velocities of a fluid of around half the speed of light. And we see that the trends with high resolution is that of, clearly it's not an ideal fluid, especially in this region here from T equals 0 to T equals 2.0. It's converging towards something that is not an ideal fluid. Okay, so we could, instead of comparing it to an ideal fluid, we can compare our gravity data translated to the conformal side to the ideal ansatz plus first order viscous corrections. And you see the difference from these two plots, it's doing slightly better, that somehow, even though somehow at initial times we seem to have bumped up a little bit, that in our deviation away from what we expect, we are doing somewhat better at a little bit later times. Yes, would you have it?
Well, I guess my question of why, yes, is hydrodynamics also dual to APS?
There is this expectation that the so-called fluid gravity correspondence, that in a certain regime, particularly in the long wavelength regime, regardless of the considerations we have right now for heavy ion collisions, you do expect fluid behavior in the conformal field theory, and we are in that regime. We are not introducing shockwave sort of behavior.
I think that's all the questions I got.
Okay, so the last thing I do is to really bump this down. So the last thing we know how to compute from ABS-CFT is second order corrections. So I really don't know how to do the higher ones, but when you add that, then we have something that pretty, if you looked at the error bars here, it's consistent with zero. So we really have explained the entire behavior in terms of fluid dynamics, but with first and second order viscous corrections.
Can you go to the previous one?
Yeah.
They're both the same size.
That's correct. But just looking at what I'm not displaying here is, if I made error bars given the trends, then the error bar here would be, not consistent with zero. Whereas here, it overlaps with zero, even at early times. It's a combination of various factors. Initial data, we make sure that it's consistent, because we have complete control of initial data. It's completely consistent. However, as I mentioned, there is this issue of transitioning in gauge because of the way that we're handling the divergences near the boundary. And because we don't have a complete understanding of it yet, we don't have a completely airtight way of doing it. So right now we have a stopgap way, which is we control it in the sense that we make sure that as you increase resolution, we're not getting a transient that's growing with resolution or getting, which is taking up more of our time region as we go at higher resolution. Right. So what I'd like now is to go back to this picture. Remember, this is our heavy ion collision. And finally make a closer connection between this picture of a fluid on essentially a three sphere to a fluid in what's closer to Minkowski space. So what you could do is go from R cross S3, the three sphere. You could position the patch where you're going to project onto, or you're going to translate to a Minkowski space, and then do a conformal mapping to take all your fluid variables and change them into something on Minkowski space. And of course, conformal weights are involved here. Here's the conformal factor. It turns out to be expressed very simply in terms of the global coordinates in this way. And temperature turns out to have a conformal weight of -1. And remember, a conformal fluid satisfies the relation that up to a constant factor that's related to the degrees of freedom in the system, the energy density is simply temperature to the power of 4. So this is where this expression comes from. It's from the conformal relation with the extra conformal weighting coming from the mapping that we're doing. And we see that in comparison to this picture of quark gluon plasma forming, so you see that most of the material goes out along the beam axis simply because the pressure gradients initially were higher because of the Lorentz contraction in that direction. We see entirely analogous behavior in this gravity constructed fluid in Minkowski space. It's just, you know, most of it expands in the beamline direction, and it expands away and finally goes outside our grid. We can't follow it anymore, simply because after the conformal transformation, most of our points are concentrated here. As you go further out, the points become less and less dense. Now, to make a really solid connection with experiment, what we'd like to do is to convert this this flow to a particle spectra. And you could do this by applying the so-called Cooper-Frye prescription. What this does is to define a hypersurface on which you'd like to, you know, find the particles. It's the hypersurface where hadronization takes place. And then apply the Cooper-Frye prescription. It simply gets the, you know, the particle distribution as a function of momentum in terms of this hypersurface normals and the fluid velocities and the temperature profile that you began with in the first place. Now, in the experiment, they don't use four momenta like we're using here, P0, P1, P2, P3. They actually use a variable called rapidity, and this is essentially, it's essentially just a boost variable in the direction of time and of the beam axis. So it's what's called y over here. And this is, in fact, what we compute to produce the particle spectrum. So we're going to be looking at the particle spectrum as a function of rapidity. And what we get is a Gaussian. The number of pions, essentially, yes. Yeah, so we're modeling pions. They could be any partons, but we're using the parameters for consistent with the pion and also consistent with a Rick collision, just to actually get numbers. So in this plot, the points are the actual data that's from the movie I showed you of the temperature profile evaluated at that hadronization hypersurface. And the line is a fit to a Gaussian of a particular form. It's of this form. It's the Landau model for heavy ion collisions. And it's the closest model to what we have because, remember, our initial data was of time symmetry. So that meant that all our velocities at the initial time were zero. And that means that we're actually closer to the Landau-Kolatnikov model of what happens after a particle collision rather than a real-world particle collision. So this is the correct form to be comparing to. And the main quantity that we'll be extracting from this plot is the question, what was the Lorentz factor of the nuclei? At what Lorentz factor did we boost them in order to produce fluid flow like we saw? Now, to give you some comparison numbers, at Rick, remember the Lorentz factor is 100. At the LHC, the Lorentz factor is 2,700. So they're pretty high. It turns out that with our data, the WY over WX is 32, we got a minuscule Lorentz factor of 1.4. So clearly, this is too small to compare directly to experiment. However, it is, at the very least, a proof of principle that this can be done, and it also suggests how to ameliorate the situation. I mean, we could simply go to higher WY over WX. That's straightforward. We could also consider larger black holes to have the same effect, to go to higher gamma factors, but it's simply a...
Hans, did you need to do that calculation to track the gamma factor with Kavask?
At the gravity side?
No, on the fluid side. I mean, you just can't compute the
that anisotropy.
Right before, you don't have the particle collision.
Yeah, it's not clear to me how you do that. Because if you just compute the velocity of the flow, I mean, the velocities we're getting were half the speed of light. So, yeah, I suppose that's sort of consistent with 1.4. It's not too far off, but I guess what we wanted was a robust way of extracting what exactly the quantity we wanted, which was the boost at the initial time, and this is this is a robust way of doing it without, you know, with fewer ambiguities, I suppose. Because, I mean, if you did something like that, it would give you an idea, as you say. In fact, you could even do it in the gravity side. You could get an idea of how high the gamma factor was by simply looking at the anisotropy of the gravity initial data you started with in the first place. But the mapping between
how do you translate that to a gamma factor?
Yeah, we didn't even try because it wasn't clear how that mapping happened. And at least to me, actually, it wasn't even clear how you would translate from a velocity profile after the post-impact to, you know, what it was initially. This, I mean, because the parton-parton interactions are pretty complicated. And perhaps you could do something like that, but I'm not sure. So this is the end of our concrete example. It's a proof of principle. It's unfortunately not quite there yet to reach the goal that I had initially set out to do, which was pretty ambitious, to describe a heavy ion collision in terms of gravity. But this does show that if you wanted to do it explicitly, you can. And this actually also shows you what direction you could go to make perhaps direct contact with experimental results.
One more question about this. That's for the range of 32. Have you done it for the range of 4 and then got what? What was the gamma there?
We have only run the. And so it turns out that the integration procedure you need to do the Cooper Fry is a little bit non-trivial. I mean, it actually would be more well adapted if we had a Cartesian-like grid as opposed to the polar-like grid we have. So in fact, that would be the best if we could. So that's exactly what I'm going to show you now, actually. But first, let me go into another project that may be of interest to others. So far, we had been, as a mechanism to form black holes, we had been using scalar fields. And remember, as I mentioned, scalar fields in ADS, massive scalar fields with mass m, well, in general, have this kind of fall off near the boundary. I mean, this I've written it in a very suggestive sort of way. These are, you can interpret these as conformal weights in the field theory side. But anyway, we've so far only been turning on this normalizable mode. So this is the piece that falls off quickly near the boundary and explicitly setting b equals 0. I mean, the way we do that is essentially just making sure that the asymptotics obeys this fall off. And simply, you know, since this falls off much more slowly, by the fact that we impose this fall off, it kills the b automatically. However, what you could do is choose, you have the choice of turning on the other boundary condition. And this corresponds to not simply exciting the field theory, but you're in fact deforming it substantially. And this turns up, this has consequences even on the gravity side. On the gravity side, this means that the boundary conditions you had before for the metric no longer hold, because at least the purely gravitational intuition is that you have matter now that's falling off so slowly that it's back reacting with the metric near the boundary in such a way that the metric itself has to fall off commensurately slowly. So this is how, for this choice, for example, we choose a particularly interesting value of negative, oh, that should be a mass squared, I'm sorry, of mass squared. This would be the fall off. It's clearly slower than the vacuum boundary conditions that we had before. And here's an example simulation for such a scalar. It's just completely spherically symmetric, but simply to show you that, you know, you could get, you know, black hole solutions with some caveats, of course. This is still a work in progress. So there are still inconsistencies that need to be worked out before we are sure about what solutions we're looking for here. So what I wanted to close with was what Louise was, you know, I guess, half asking. But what I'd mentioned was it would be nice for very many reasons to have a more Cartesian-like code. Now, notice in all the simulations I've had so far, the boundary is very, very smooth. And the reason is that the coordinates we have, even though they're evolving according to the source functions, they're polar-like. in the sense that we had, you know, that one of the coordinates went in this direction, concentric half circles, and the other coordinate went in this direction, the radial direction. And so that the implications of that first is that the boundary is much easier to deal with simply because your coordinates are well adapted to the boundary. However, on the origin, you have a coordinate singularity, and numerically this means that you have the CFL factor, or sorry, the CFL condition to deal with. This is essentially a condition that tells you that your time step, you have to take very small time steps simply because of the fact that your effective grid size here is getting very small. Your spatial effective spatial grid size is getting very small. So that limits a lot of simulations. And in fact, the way we dealt with it in all the simulations so far was simply to hide this coordinate singularity by putting another singularity there, the black hole one. And we could excise that by reasons of causality. And so we're happy. We don't have that problem anymore. However, we would like, for example, if we wanted to do a simulation that was indeed just these two gold atoms before they collided and formed, you know, quark, gluon, plasma, which we argued was dual somehow to a black hole. Then what we really want to do it properly would be a spacetime that started off with initial data with two lumps, either black holes, cue balls, scalar field lumps, what have you, as long as they form a black hole in the end. But the point is, it would be ideal to have a spacetime that had that started off with a slice that didn't contain a trapped surface to begin with. So here's one example of this new Cartesian code. I've just started two Gaussian lumps of scalar field, set them off. I think I'll evolve this for one light crossing time, just to verify that at least for the small scalar field I put there, they should just they just exchange places, basically. I put them in opposite positions in ADS. So this is the sort of code that, you know, you might want for problems like that. And in fact, now that we're starting to think about actually going to the full 3+1 computation, the important question is this, you know, how do we want to do it? Because you can't just relax symmetries naively. That will cost you months of work. So the question is, would we want something that's more like this, a Cartesian-like code, and then expand that to 3+1 dimensions? Or is it enough to do a spherical type code and simply you know, relax our symmetry and just include one more angular? So that's the question I'll leave you with, and I think I'd leave the floor open for questions. Thank you.
Yes. What is the main new bit of physics that you're hoping to see when you go to 3+1?
The problem with 2+1 at the moment is that we're relying very heavily on the conformal transformation, in the sense that if we did the projection to the boundary in a naive way, our SO3 symmetry translates to SO3 translates to spherical symmetry. So we would only be able to study spherically symmetric flows. That is certainly not anything close to a particle collision. However, what we have done is to do a conformal transformation. We shifted our Poincaré patch and did a conformal transformation in such a way that it's still an SO3, but it's a conformal SO3, that you've broken the SO3 into an SO2 piece, actually symmetric piece, cross special conformal transformations. So that's essentially the symmetry of the pictures I was showing you in Minkowski space. That's why we managed to get away with just having an SO3 symmetry in the bulk, and yet we got a non-spherically symmetric situation in the boundary. It's the power of conformal transformations, at least in the global picture, because you have that freedom. However, if we did a full 3+1 simulation, you could only go so far with conformal mappings. You can't, for example, map it to something that started off with a situation that looked like that, and then, you know, but for that, you really do need 3+1.
Actually, I realize I said 3+1, but I meant 4+1. You're actually eventually trying to simulate a 5D ball.
Yes, right? That's right.
But the 3+1, the one that you're turning the one parameter's worth of simplification to get the
right
down the ball.
So that's the question that I had left you with, because at the moment we're doing 2+1 simulations, remember? So from my point of view, the question is this: what symmetry should we relax to get to 3+1 simulation in such a way that it's most well adapted to this problem, or to whatever problem we're considering, either heavy ion collisions or something else? So it's exactly the question you're asking. And it's not yet completely clear in my mind how to do it. Perhaps one way would just be to do a Poincaré patch code. Then it's obvious what to do, because the Poincaré patch boundary is exactly in Kautsky space. So you know exactly what symmetries correspond to what in the bulk and so on. But in the global picture, it's not, I mean, it might be straightforward, but it's not. What's not straightforward is what is the path of least resistance, because that's what's worth it to really think through it properly and make sure that you do the thing that's that'll get you the most for the effort you put in. And it's not clear to me yet what that is. What symmetries would it correspond to, 3+1, that would get us the most as we put in.
So Hans, what you could do here to exploit the R code? I mean, if you happen to have issues still with boundaries,
yeah,
you can patch the Cartesian to
cylindrical. So the multi-patch might be the way to go, we were thinking. But so the reason, so it's a lot of effort, but why, might as well do it. But second, I still feel that given the machinery of the source functions we've developed, of finding the source functions, I mean, there must be a way of doing this properly. And it would be really satisfying if I could find a fundamental explanation for why this sort of thing is working. And then this would work automatically, because it just follows, it's just a choice of source function. But you're right, we could do that, and then we could just use exactly the same source function choice we did before.
Any other questions? So if not, let's thank Hans again.